sound is.
G'day, Nick.
G'day, Tom.
Here we are.
Unbelievable. We've come a long way.
Welcome to the world of podcasting.
Can you believe it? Mate, it's great to be here.
Well, and to everyone listening, welcome to the first episode of what we're calling Ouzo Talk, because that's what we do. We drink ouzo and we talk a bit of crap, all sorts of topics, especially now during lockdown.
That's right. Yeah, well, that's how we started, isn't it, Tom? Was it 16 weeks ago? Sydney came into lockdown.
16 weeks of lockdown, yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
And for our own mental health, we'd meet up at Mooch and Me, good old Bill and Pete Mugios.
Brighton La Sands down in Sydney.
Correct, yeah. They offered free coffee and juice for the month of July. I thought, what a great way to meet up and start our lunch break. So we met up down there. I think that's how we started, isn't it? Got
Absolutely.
Our juice and coffee, went for a walk, and we just started talking.
Absolutely. And it's been great so far. I mean, just the conversations that we've had up until this point, we thought, why not bring it to everyone else? So why don't we tell everyone what the deal actually is? So as Nick's just said, we've worked from home all the way through Sydney's most recent lockdown, which has been around 16 weeks now. And it's at the time of recording, we're just about to come out of it. So during this time, we've enjoyed daily walks during our downtime, and some really interesting conversations have come out of it. And most of them center around Greece, given our background. Greece and our Greekness, let's say.
Greek heritage.
That's right. So we've covered everything from food, travel and culture, politics, science, history and philosophy, and everything in between. And these are conversations that happen all the time between friends in coffee shops and barakea in Greece and all that sort of thing. So we thought, why not just put a microphone between us, or a couple of microphones, and start just having those conversations and bring them to you. And another thing that we'll be doing is actually bringing in well-known Greeks within our community who maybe have businesses or know a particular skill that might be of interest to people. We're big rugby league fans as well, so we're hoping to bring in a little bit around the Greek rugby league. So let's just see what happens, Nick.
Yeah, that sounds great, Tom.
Should we have a drink?
I think so, mate.
All right, let's do it. So what are we drinking today, Nick?
Blumari. Beautiful. It's one of my favorites, actually.
It's definitely one of my favorites. I'll tell you something. Every time I drink a lot of ouzo, not in an alcoholic sense. I drink a fair bit of ouzo. You'd have to ask my wife. Yeah, I drink a fair bit of ouzo, and quite honestly, the Blumari is among my favorites, primarily because you can drink half a bottle, and for me personally, don't get a hangover.
True.
Whereas with some other brands who shall remain nameless for the sake of this podcast, if you wake up feeling a little bit dusty. But
I love the smoothness of it. It just goes down really easy. It's easy to drink.
How do you normally drink yours?
Plenty of ice, a little bit of water, touch of water.
Very nice.
Let it sit for a while and just sip on it.
Yep. And we've got the accompaniments here with it as well. Nick's gone all out. I mean, he got a recipe off my wife for chtapodaki xidato, or octopus in vinegar, for the lay people out there, and it's outstanding. You've done a great job.
You like it? Thanks, mate. What about the olives? I made some olives this season as well.
You know what? I haven't tried the olives yet. I'll do that in the break.
It's the only way we can. Yeah, thanks, Tom. It's great. It's the best way to drink ouzo with a bit of mezedaki on the side.
I think so. And Blumari, look, again, this is one of the historic brands as well, from the town of Blumari, which is only just over 3,000 people population, obviously in Lesbos. Mm-hmm. Founded in 1894 by Isidoros Arvanitis. And the story goes that it was his dream, basically, to make his own brand of ouzo that was fairly unique. And he did a fair bit of extensive traveling to find ingredients and whatnot to actually do that. The interesting thing, though, is that on one of his travels to France, he met up with a friend of his and he shared his idea that he wanted to make his own ouzo. And his mate basically said to him, it'll never happen.
Is this when they had that bet?
Yes. That's right. Yeah. So this
story.
Yeah. So this story. Yeah. So the story basically goes that his mate bet him a gold coin that his dream wouldn't come true. So obviously, being the kind of Greek that he was, you know, most Greeks, very stubborn, as we all are, as you know.
Possibly a bit of a punter.
Yep, absolutely. Basically went back home to his town and said, let's make a go of this and let's see if I can make my friend look silly. And when he finally did create the ouzo that we now know as Plomari, he sent his mate a bottle of it, to which his friend responded by sending him a gold dollar, a gold coin rather.
Yeah.
So obviously won the bet. And it actually, funnily enough, that logo that's on the bottle there, the gold coin with
the wings on it,
with the wings, is part testament that to that story. Yeah, absolutely.
No, fantastic, mate.
Very interesting stuff.
It is really good stuff.
We're drinking history.
We are. Yeah, well, speaking of history, we got to thank the monks of Mount Athos as well.
Is that right?
Yeah, they turned Tsipro into ouzo.
Is that
back in the 14th century, yeah. So the monks at Mount Athos, I guess they would have been occupied under the Ottomans by then. What's the best way to get through an occupation? Drink some ouzo.
Look at you doing your research. It's outstanding.
That's what happens when you travel through Greece. You just get inquisitive and you ask questions.
Is that where you found out?
Yeah, I did. I didn't actually get to Mount Athos, though, but I got to Medeora, and the monks there were telling me. I said, the monks in Mount Athos invented ouzo. Tsipro came first, would you believe? I always thought it was the other way around.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
But if you've had Tsipro, you can work out why they put aniseed in it to make it taste better.
That's an interesting point, because there's two different types of Tsipro that we get, you know, that we can buy here in Australia at the moment. Not that there's many choices, but there's obviously the one that's got aniseed in it, which is more akin to ouzo. Mm-hmm. But then you've got the other one, which is pure lighter fluid.
Yeah.
Pure methylated spirits, which, you know, I don't know if it's saying much about me, but that's the one that I prefer.
Yeah. So my mum goes to Greece, or she used to go to Greece every year before lockdown the last 2 years. And that was on my list. Bring back a bag of rigani and Tsipro. And unfortunately, the Tsipro comes in a Pepsi bottle. So I'm not sure if we're allowed to bring it in, customs officials. However, it comes in a Pepsi bottle.
That was going to be my next question. How do you get that through customs and quarantine?
Idea. Yeah, I don't know. They must know. I don't know. But yeah, it usually lasts you the winter as well. You know, come back and there's nothing better than a hard day's work. Come home and have a shot at Tsipro. Warm you up.
And it's multi-purpose. It's not just for drinking.
It's medicinal. I don't think I ever get a flu in winter.
They used to use Tsipro to rub people's backs and chest with, as though it was Vicks.
Okay.
So imagine rubbing yourself with that and getting close to the fire.
Yeah, and drinking it. Imagine the insides drinking that. Yeah, we're from the mountains of Epiro, so yeah, we get the hard stuff.
Yeah, right.
And it's beautiful. So the produce up there in the mountains, it's all clean, it's all fresh, and Mum would go and meet a couple of our old ancestors, her cousins, her older uncles back in the day. And, yeah, they'd bring this amazing, beautiful Tsipro in.
Outstanding.
And there'd be no preservatives, nothing in it. So definitely every winter, that's how I survive winter. One shot of that after work and life's great.
Everything looks better after a shot of that. You've got the Tsipro goggles on.
Yes, that's right. But, yeah, only one shot. If you have two or three, I think you start to head downhill. It's not good for you. One is good for you, maybe two.
Yep.
But the third and fourth one, it's not good.
Yeah, right. I believe you. Well, tell me a little bit about your Greek background or your Greek credentials. So you mentioned there, you know, your family's from Epiro.
Yeah, so Mum and Dad were born in Thesprotia in the mountains of Epiro. We now have the Amerisman Igoumenitsa, so I guess we call that home when we head over there. So I was born here, obviously, in Sydney, Australia. They were mountainous people. So all our ancestors came from Elateria, which is a mountainous village deep in the mountains. I guess then their claim to fame is not one Turk during the occupation ever set foot in Elateria.
Right.
So the whole village is surrounded by cliff face and pine trees. And even when I went in 95 with my uncle, we went through this dirt track. We sort of zigzagged up the side of the mountain in his car with no suspension. My head hit the roof several times going up there. My uncle is a legend. He was actually a Greek legend in the army. He was a resistance fighter in World War II, and he had amazing stories. I guess that might be another podcast we could talk about. But But yeah, it was mate. He took me up, and we got up there, and I said, "Ah, Theo, where's the village that you talk about?" He goes, "This is it." In Greek, obviously. Yeah, the way I must have had a look. Couldn't see anything. And he said, "I said, Petres, you know, if you look on the other side, you know, Spiti." So we walked down, and they used, I guess, the landscape to hide, you know, the main entrance. They used the landscape to hide the entrance to the village. Right. Then as we walked in further, you could see, you know, there's 2,000 people lived in this area. Yeah, most of the houses were built out of stone. All the houses were built out of stone and wood. And yeah, the community survived for 200-300 years, I guess,
right,
in this area.
And is that both sides of your family come from there?
Both sides, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah.
So in the 1950s, after the First World War, Second World War, I should say, rather, Dad's family moved to Petrovica, Mum's moved to Parapotamos. So they moved out of their villages, and then in the 60s, they got an opportunity to come to Australia, and that's how I ended up
interesting
here, yeah. Tell me about your ancestors.
Well, all my family is from Corfu. So on both sides, my mum was actually born in Corfu. Dad was born here, but his parents migrated from there in sort of the mid-50s and early 60s. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as far back as we can sort of tell, all of our family is from there, and not even by design. I married a girl from Corfu as well.
Fantastic,
so,
mate.
So we're keeping it all in the family. We're all very close to each other. I mean, it's a fairly big island, by comparison. So my family's generally from like central Corfu, so a village is called Kinopiastes, Gasturi, and Katogaruna. And my wife's family is from a very well-known part of Corfu called Paleokastritsa, which is effectively a resort, Corfu's resort in some respects. It's a good mix.
Yeah,
it's a good mix. But we go back pre-COVID. We try to go back once a year at least, and sort of reconnect with the roots. It's good for the soul, mate. Every time you get in the water over there, it's like being baptized all over again.
Oh, yeah. Look, I think I've been to Greece several times, Tom, and when you come back, it's sort of depression sits in. You know, you think, what's wrong with me? You know, I just can't get into society. It takes like a good month or two to get back into it. And that's what it is. It's the air, it's the water, the food, the people, the atmosphere. Combine that, you know, it's such a relaxed, beautiful place. And coming back to a society, you know, Sydney's like a little mini New York, you know, it's everyone's in a rush, everyone's busy, everyone doesn't have time for anything, we're all busy doing co-curricular stuff, you know, we're all trying to get ahead. But yeah, coming back, it does hit you. I'm not sure, there'll be a common theme for a lot of our viewers as well. Coming back from Greece, it takes a while to get to adjust to society.
It takes me at least 2 to 3 weeks to sort of come down from it, really. And it is that depression. And everyone that I know sort of talks about that. As soon as they land here, back from, you know, one of their summer trips to Greece, no matter where they've been, it's always a case of, man, what am I doing back here?
Jet lag doesn't help. We're so far away from Europe.
Yeah, I know. But I know. It's probably easier for our friends over in the US. But as soon as we arrive back here, it's always a case of I'm already making plans on how I'm going back.
Yeah. No, I hear you, mate. It's it's amazing. Even just the simple things that we miss, like a good frappe in the morning, going from beach to beach. You know, we could have like a 10-hour day and go to 3 different beaches during the day.
Yeah.
And possibly put 1 coat of sun cream on and be in the sun for 10 hours and have no worries.
Yeah, what is that? I mean, we spoke about this the other day at the beach, you know, that thing karoten that everyone puts on. If you put that on here,
it just puts a smile on my face when you say that.
It's the smell of summer in Greece, really, isn't it? I mean, but if you put that on in Australia, I mean, you may as well say it's cancer in a bottle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. And that's what it is. And how good is it? You go to a beach, like, again, we talk about Ipiro. I've done that coastline several times, back of a papaki. And I think, what was it? A beach called Xavier. I remember we went to a beach called Xavier. It's like a little dirt road. You go down this dirt road. Actually, it might have changed now. Things have progressed, I guess. Go down this dirt road and you meet the guy that runs the little cafeteria there. And here's the actual the local fisherman,
yep.
And he opens a basket. Did they let the poroi no? But we have a look at his catch of the day. I think, you know what, we're going to have that for lunch. So you basically hand pick what you want to eat for lunch from his catch of the day. Then you just sit at the beach, swim all day, read your book, do what you have to do, and then amazing fresh seafood meal just comes to you.
I mean, do you think that being here we idealize that sort of life, and obviously it would be different to live there.
Look, I guess because we're on holidays, when you're on holiday mode, things are a little bit different. Could I live there? Look, if you didn't have to work, 100%. A lot of Australians do that, especially the ones that were born there. They come here, they work, and they retire there, or they come back every year, or they spend 6 months there, 6 months in Australia. Look, the systems are great in Australia, we've got everything set up, license, banks, the footpath, everything just seems pretty structured. And the systems we've got in place are really good. But in Greece, a little bit of work on that, I think.
It's just a little bit frustrating.
Just sometimes. A little bit, yeah. Or something we're not used to, I guess. But then again, that's what makes Greece, Greece,
Absolutely.
It's a beautiful place. And they're not so stressed and structured in such a way where it definitely feel like you're free. You do whatever you want, eat whatever you want. I think you had a story the other day about hiring cars and, no one cares. Yeah, okay, I trust you.
What do you want? You want a bike? Sure, go for it. Do you want my license? No.
No, it's okay.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's right. Can you ride a bike? Yeah, sure. It's that Philotimo thing. It's that village mentality. The cosmos. You're one of us. It's okay. Yeah. Now, when was the last time you were in Corfu?
Last time we went was, when was it? Winter 2019 leading into 2020. So just before all this COVID stuff erupted. So we were over there for my sister-in-law's wedding. So we stayed all through December and the majority of January. Yeah, load me up here, mate. Pour another drink. Outstanding. Thank you very much.
Have a man with an empty glass.
Absolutely.
In front of you.
Yamas, mate.
Yamas, mate. This is, Lomati's going down really well, actually.
It is. It is. Cheers.
I think the more we drink, the better stories we have, I think.
can we take that philosophy into work?
Oh, definitely, mate.
Zoom call and an ouzo.
Very productive.
Absolutely. We left there, I think it was mid-January, and just a couple of weeks afterwards, all the stuff around COVID really started to get real. It was a fantastic trip. I mean, we've been to Corfu and Greece in general in winter a few times now. Most people obviously experience it in summer, and that's its own thing. Summer holidays, you can't go past that.
Yeah.
But during winter, it's got its own charms. It's got its own unique. It's going to the Buzukya. The partying, it is just unbelievable. Even just the cafe near, sitting there, all the guys having their having their Greek coffee, playing tavli, playing cards,
doing what we're doing actually, sitting on a frappé for 5 hours and fixing the world's problems.
Absolutely.
6 hours, okay.
That's absolutely. When was the last time you were there?
2013, actually. So it was an interesting time, 2013. I was actually working for an airline back then, Qantas Airways, and one of my roles was to bring back all the Australian athletes from the London Olympics.
Sorry, 2012
that was. And so that was an amazing time. Did some work in London, and I had a cousin that was getting married in Igoumenitsa. And went to work, finished work, had an annual leave, came in and had an amazing time at a wedding. Met up with a lot of my cousins. And,
outstanding.
Growing up, I guess we sort of were Greek, but we were maybe a little bit embarrassed, I think. And the older you got, you became more Greek, if it makes sense. Maybe I'm talking from a generation perspective. So I'm talking about the 80s now. It wasn't really cool to be Greek and have a Greek name. But the older you got, it became really cool. We're sort of a bit embarrassed, but especially going to school, playing rugby league, it wasn't cool to be a wogger, so to speak. But the older you got, you became really aligned with your culture. I said, drinking ouzo and being proud of your heritage. We sort of always were proud of our heritage, but the more exposure we got to Greece, you think, fuck, what am I embarrassing? This is a fucking good culture. Yeah. Like, how good are we? How good is everything?
I think a lot of it is because the older generation sort of forced it on you. Mm. And because it was being forced on you and you were being teased about it at school and people were making it difficult, mm-hmm. it's sort of difficult to have that sort of relationship.
Mm.
But as you get older and you start to realize a few things, you really start to realize that, hold on a sec, this actually really makes sense. This culture makes sense. It's the reason why I am the way I am.
Mm.
And that's, funnily enough, that's something that I found as well. You know, I didn't really hang out with many Greeks in my year in high school, for example. I mean, I knew some, but my circle of friends was by no means Greek. I hung out primarily with, what most Greeks would call the skips.
Yeah.
So, and played rugby league and played in bands and all that sort of thing with music. But really didn't find my sense of self until starting to go back to Greece by myself. And that sort of began around 2007,
mm.
When I went on a trip with all of those friends from high school,
mm.
And ended up in Greece and really rediscovered that Greekness and what it meant to be Greek. And a lot of it is what we've already been talking about. It's that,
mm.
it's that free spirit. It's the, it's that connection to family.
Yeah.
It's all of that stuff. And it just really made sense in the end.
Yeah. It's amazing that you touched on that as well. Cause I was the same, I felt like not lost, but sort of, where do I fit? I'm trying really hard to fit into society. Yeah. And again, I was born here,
mm.
End of the day, I did fit in, I guess. Obviously, I shouldn't say that in a harsh way. But when I went to Greece, I felt complete. Okay, this is me. This is my people. This is where I'm.
Yeah.
This is how we live. And that 2012 trip really made it for me. I was actually on my own. Look, there's two parts to that. My dad, rest his soul, he was suffering from dementia at the time.
Right.
And the last thing I wanted to do was take him to Greece. I had all these things I wanted to do for my poor dad. And last one was just to take him to Greece so he could say goodbye to all these relos. I knew it was one of those shit diseases that yep. you're never going to come out of. And essentially I said, look, if I can't take you to Greece, I'll bring Greece to you. So one of my thought processes was, how about we? I'll go over and I'll do some recordings. I'll record his sisters, right. his relos, his cousins, and just ask him some questions,
Wow.
and record all that and then bring that to him. So then the process was, well, how the hell am I going to get to Greece? What's going on? And then all of a sudden, London Olympics came up. Boss comes up, hey, Nick, do you want to work out that process of how we bring all the athletes back? And I said, I'd love it. When is it? It was London. And then lo and behold, 4 or 5 days later, my cousin was getting married in Greece. So I thought, everything is aligning.
Yeah.
Okay, this is unbelievable. It's like a divine intervention.
Yeah.
But how the hell am I going to make this last dream for my dad, bring Greece to him? I can't take him over there. And everything just sort of fell into place. I led the team over to London. We did all the processing. We brought all the athletes back, and it was an amazing piece of project management work that we did. My job ended as soon as the last plane pushed back to Sydney.
Sure.
I jumped on a plane to Corfu, would you believe?
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's right. Caught the ferry over to Gumenitsa. Caught up with my cousin who was getting married at the time. Johnny boy, your legend. It was a... You probably don't realize how much your wedding, how important it was to me, but I don't think I've ever spoken to you about this, John, if you're listening to this, but but it was, yeah, it was amazing. And by the way, John lives at Brighton, around the corner from here.
So, right, okay.
So, we caught up, I was there for the wedding, and I said, my mission is to do all these recordings and send back, take back and let my dad watch it for the last time. So I went into the mountains, into the villages. I caught up with his sisters, friends he went to school with, his cousins, local village people, and I asked them 3 questions. I said, tell me what your name is. Tell me how you related to my dad. And then tell me your funny story about who your dad and how you and my dad interacted.
Right.
And that was it. And it was amazing. I ended up getting 17 videos. It was amazing. But that's where I really, really discovered my true Greekness, my true roots of, mountain Epirus. where I came from, hearing their stories, going into these homes and hearing their amazing stories of how they interacted with my dad, and they talked about our ancestors and how they played together growing up in the, you know, in the 50s, you know, in the late 40s after World War II.
Right.
It really, really hit home for me. So, but yeah, it was amazing. Yeah, came home, went to the wedding. The wedding was amazing. The Bucks party started at midnight. Yeah.
Like most good events over there.
Yeah. So, you know, it took me a while. I got used to it eventually, but it was amazing. You get up late. You spend all day at the beach. You actually, you don't really have breakfast. They're not big on breakfast, Greeks, are they?
No.
It's more like a frappe and a cigarette that I smoke, but
it's usually a frappe.
Yeah.
The requisite cigarette. And then on your way to wherever you're going, you might have a tiropita.
Yeah.
That's it. About it.
Perfect. And then lunch is a massive feast where I think it's you get into a food coma. That's why you go to sleep. But the Greeks say it's the weather, which it is. It's fucking hot there when it gets really hot in Greece. So I can understand why they're not going to. Who's going to go and work, play out the fields or work, you know, at 1 in the afternoon when it's like 50 degrees?
Yeah, that's not happening.
No. Classic, yeah. So that's what you do. So I did what the Greeks did. You know, went to sleep, got out of bed at 4 or 5 in the afternoon, you know, woke up, had a chat, and, we sort of go out to dinner. Everything happens late in Greece, which that's the bit I loved. You know, there's no structure, there's no time. It's just, you know, you have your rest, you have your sleep, you get up and do what you have to do. And that was it. It was an amazing night. Anyway, Johnny, your wedding was amazing and a lot of good memories.
Outstanding. Well, we could do a podcast just on that.
We could, yeah. I could do a 24-hour podcast on what I got up to. Tom, if you're listening from Athens, from Glyphada, you probably will get a mention in hopefully we do a couple more podcasts, Tom. Tom Bickus, his name is, from Glyphada, a bit of a legend there and a bit of a historian as well and a great storyteller. We could actually bring him on here, actually.
But, yeah, right.
Yeah, but he knows all that region really well, and the 24 hours I spent with him, I've never laughed so hard in my life or drunk so much, where I ended up at home at, I think it was like 9 a.m., no sleep, 9 a.m., ready to go to bed, and he was sitting on the side. He goes, what do you mean you're going to go? Let's just sit on the back and have another drink. Look, Tom.
My wife tells the story that when she moved to Athens from Corfu to study. Her sister was already in Athens at the time studying, and she'd been there for a couple of years already. And my wife hadn't really been out partying in the same way that her sister might have, being a few years older. And they decided to go to the Bouzoukia one night.
Mm-hmm.
And her sister said to her before they went out, you know, I'm assuming it was around midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning or so that they went. She said, take your sunglasses with you. and my wife's like, what are you talking about? Why? And she goes, just take your sunglasses with you. She goes, trust me. Anyway, so they went to the Bouzoukia. Through their connections, they had a really good table right up the front and whatnot, had an absolute ball and didn't get out of there until about 7:30 in the morning. So the reason why she had her sunglasses became very apparent, especially after the amount they'd had to drink. You know, they're walking out there. She's put her sunglasses on and gone straight for a vromiko. You know what a vromiko is?
No, what is it? What's a vromiko?
It's basically a sandwich that's got everything in it. You can put souvlaki in it. You can put gyro in it. You can put, you know.
Really?
It's like it's Greece's answer to drunk food. You'd think it was the gyro or patsa, like most people say.
Oof.
The vromiko is the big thing. It's just a really. Or like it that's sounds, exactly. A dirty sandwich.
Yeah.
It's outstanding.
Isn't that what we call McDonald's? Is that what we do here in Sydney, Australia?
Absolutely. Well, the quality of the drunk food or the hangover food in Greece is just outstanding.
Right.
and having it at 7:30 in the morning with your sunnies on just caps it off.
Fantastic. The vromiko. I
can't believe you've never heard of that.
No, never heard of the vromiko. Far out.
It's an Athenian institution as far as I'm aware.
Okay. Yeah, fantastic. Did you end up doing a night swim? Because my cousin Tom ended up taking me to do a night swim at 11 o'clock at night.
It's happened a few times on my end.
Yeah, this is after all day of trekking through the village, having tsipro after tsipro, meeting people, interviewing them. You know, I wasn't allowed to sit still, you know. And he goes, Nick, we've got to do a night swim. Well, what do you mean? Because everyone does a night swim. Come on, up you get. Oh, fuck me. All right, let's go. It's a belly full of tipiro and food because every house you go to feeds you.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm doing, and then he said, you know, because he was born in Australia, he goes, you know, I'm a really good swimmer, you know. You know, Australians are renowned for their swimmers. Yeah. So I said, okay, because I want to give you a swimming race. I said, I want to show you how good I can swim.
At what time was this?
At 11 o'clock at night.
Right.
With about maybe 5 tipiro in my belly.
Yeah, right.
Remember I said earlier, 1 or 2 is good for you? Yeah. So anything after two
is everything good. You learn at Nippers here went straight out the window.
That's right. Yeah. Anything. Yeah. Oh, it's crazy.
Surf life-saving.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So my boys are surf lifesavers at the moment.
Right.
So they've got patrol. Liam had patrol today, unfortunately. Okay. He couldn't go. He had his second COVID jab.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, they do patrol down at Cronulla Beach here.
Okay.
Yeah. So Tom wanted to challenge me in a swimming race in Vrepono in Gumenica. I said, Tom, you've got to be kidding. And he goes, yes. Come on, cuz, let's go. It's all right.
Jeez.
And here's me, you know, natural competitiveness, playing football. You know, that's all we do is play sport here. Yep. So I'm having a swimming race at 11 o'clock at night with my cousin Tom with a beer full of tipiro and food like olives and feta and whatever you can think of. Yeah, breads and homemade bread. Anyway, we nearly threw up. I couldn't believe it. And I thought, fuck. And this was before we got to the Bucks party.
Yeah.
So we had to swim race.
Did it wake you up at all, though?
It did.
Yep.
It did. Yeah, I cursed him afterwards. I said, what the hell did you make me do that for? You lucker, what are you doing? But anyway, it was a top trip. It was a top trip. Yeah. Anyway, then we ended up going to the Bucks party. So they do Bucks parties a bit different to us here. They have the bride and the groom go together.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because I went to one in 2019 for my... my sister-in-law, well, for her husband.
Yeah.
We went to Thessaloniki. We did a road trip to Thessaloniki to go to the Bouzoukia to see Paola, of all people.
Fantastic. Well, we must let the viewers know. There is a bit of an age gap between me and Tom. So.
How old are you?
I'm 47.
Okay.
Ready to hit 48 next month. Yeah. Less than a month.
And I'm 33.
Okay. So we've got a good 15 years, mate.
Yeah.
So... it's a big age gap.
It is, mate.
Yeah, it's good. 2 generations, I guess.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And the funny thing is how you and I connected, though, because we were both working at Qantas at the time.
That's right.
And what happened? I'm sitting at my desk, and you know, I was in prime position at Qantas. My desk situated right outside the bathroom.
I went in to chug a piss, came out. Well, that's an interesting flag on your desk.
Yeah.
Where's that from?
Yeah.
And then you said, oh, it's from Corfu. I thought, oh, you're Greek. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't look very Greek. Oh, you do look Greek, I guess, coming from Corfu.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blue eyes. Maybe we should send a photo to our viewers.
Yeah, maybe.
You guys can decide.
But yeah, we were kind of drawn to each other, you know, for some reason. I find that a lot with, you know.
With Greeks.
We sniff each other out. Yeah. In some way.
Exactly. You're right. And that was it. It was just that instant connection. As soon as you said you agree, oh, bang.
Yeah.
It's like magnets. Poof. That was it.
All of a sudden, everyone else around you is like, okay, all right, I've found one of my people.
You know? Yeah, that's right. We had a chat. We laughed. We carried on. We had the same interests, same things, and that was it.
That's right. That's right.
How long ago was that, Tom? Got a better memory than me. You're younger than me.
That would be, I'm going to say it's 5 years ago now.
5 years ago?
Yeah.
Is that
it? It's not that long.
Your glass is empty.
I know. Well, I tell you what, the good people at Plomario, they're doing a good job on us.
Out of Anitis, you legend, mate.
That's it. Yamas.
Yamas, mate.
Beautiful.
This has gone down really good.
Absolutely. And there's not even ice anymore. It's great.
Mm.
Good with ice, good without it.
Yeah. It's heavy with no ice. Straight. No water. Didn't I say earlier in the podcast I like with a bit of water and ice? That's gone out the window really quickly.
Well, we're halfway through the bottle already.
Yeah. Shit. What happened to our coffee and walk along the beach and solve the world's problems?
We'll solve someone's problems. During this conversation, it won't be the world's, though.
Yeah, far out. Yeah, we've got a long way to go. Actually, we've got to get to the end of the bottle before we start solving the world's problems, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think?
dear.
I love it. Yeah, that's what it is with Greeks around the world. I remember when I was backpacking, again, dare I say it, 1995, bumped into Greek Canadians, Greek Americans.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. We all spoke English with a different type of twang, different type of accent. But as soon as you're Greek, it was that connection.
Yeah.
Straight away. It's hard to explain unless you've experienced it. And I'm sure most of the people listening to this would have experienced it. Met a bunch of Greek Canadian boys. And as soon as we heard we're Greek, oh, that was it. It was like we're brothers. It's like connection. I hadn't met them, like, within the next 2 minutes, we're like brothers.
Yeah.
You agree? Ah, that was it. You know, shoulders dropped. Okay, it's like I'm home.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I went backpacking around the world on my own. So I was on my own, and when you meet people with the same culture, I guess same thought process, same upbringing, we all would have had the same upbringing.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Yeah, it doesn't matter. I was never born in Greece. You know, I feel like I had no real connection to Greece growing up, but somehow there was something in me, and it completed you as soon as you got there. Yeah, and that was it. So, yeah, backpacking around the world, meeting these Canadian boys, that was it. We're like brothers. You know, we had each other's back straight away. I thought, wow, had that connection.
Yeah.
Yeah, still never really sunk in yet what it meant to be Greek, but that's what it is. You can go anywhere around the world. Actually, I'll tell you a story. I was going to, I was in Jordan. I was going to go see the monuments in Petra. It was amazing. So I met another backpacker.
Beautiful part of the world.
Yeah, amazing. I met another backpacker and he goes, look, I was going to head to Egypt to see the pyramids. And he goes, you know what? Go to Jordan. Go to Petra. Petra, amazing. Mm. Yeah. Petra, Greek word, rock. You know, so it's literally a village carved out of a rock.
Yep.
You know, amazing. So I didn't know much about it. Again, this was back in 95, so we had no internet. All you had was Let's Go Europe, which is a guidebook that we used back then. And Australians had Lonely Planet.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I bought the wrong one. I bought the Let's Go Europe. So everywhere I went, all I hear was the story, hey, there's so many Australians backpacking. I thought, I haven't fucking met any. Where are they? Well, I met was Americans and Canadians because I was using the wrong guidebook. That's what it was. Let's Go Europe. And so it was my brother actually. He reckoned because he did the same thing.
Yeah.
He goes, Let's Go Europe, better guidebook. But then The Lonely Planet was a good one. Anyway, long story short, we ended up going to Petra. And I didn't have any, the local currency, which was dinar. And I thought, okay, shit, how am I going to get through? I need money. I need to, you know, live through the day and so forth.
Right.
So I spoke to the local guy and I said, look, again, international language, using your hands and trying to sound every letter out. And I said, hey, I need a dinar. And I was rubbing my hand and he said, okay, travel agent. And he sort of gave me directions, you know, down the road, turn left, turn right. Second, you know, travel agent on the second on the block. Okay, great. Went down. And anyway, I sat there with a guy who's dressed in the Jordanian outfit.
Right.
Having a chat or trying to talk to him, trying to explain to him that I needed local currency.
When you say Jordanian outfit, the thing that immediately comes to mind, you know, Greek outfit like fustaneles and all that sort of thing. Is this a similar sort of thing?
No, you know what? It was all white. Like a white gown. Oh, okay, and
So kind of like what the Saudis do, you know, with their...
Yeah, with the benello and the white thing on their head.
Right, okay, yeah. Gotcha.
So it was like that. So he didn't look Greek.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought, okay, who's this guy? Okay, and if I started talking.
Yep.
Said, need some dinner. And he's like, okay, your pasaporta. And I handed him a passport, looked at my name, and he goes, Elena Cese. I thought, what? Nearly fell off my chair. I said, are you Greek? And he goes, in Greek. And he goes, no, Elena's in. Okay.
Wow.
I said, hang on. I said, whoa, okay. How the hell do you speak Greek? What's going on?
Yeah.
And he just went on and gave me this history of his ancestors who came from Asia Minor, you know, in 1922. Okay. They all went fled, you know, all fled to, you know, they didn't just go to Greece. They went to Lebanon, they went to Jordan, they went to all the countries that bordered Turkey. And he was one of them. And somehow the culture remained. So his grandfather would have been one of the people that would have got pushed out of Turkey at that time.
Right.
And we spoke for ages. Yeah, it was amazing. Again, we just connected again. Yeah, it was
Did he give you the money?
He did. He did. Oh, he was so accommodating. You know, yeah. He screamed out to his wife, bring some drinks for the boys. Yeah, we've got a Greek from Australia here. And that was it. And I spent the next 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the guy at the youth hostel said, did you get lost? What happened to you?
Yeah.
I said, no. I just met a guy and we started chatting, you know, yeah. And that was it. And he said, there's this area in Jordan, there's a lot of Greeks here. You know, we all talk Greek. Yeah, you know, the kids go to school. He spoke Greek like me, I guess, you know, second generation. Right. But yeah, it didn't really look Greek, to be honest with you. I guess, what does a Greek look like? Who knows? But his dress sense was local custom. You know, I guess it's like us wearing billabong board shorts and singlets and so forth. But it was Greek, and that was it. And we connected. It was amazing. We had an amazing chat, a lot about the history of Greeks that left, you know, Asia Minor and went to Jordan. Yeah, it was amazing. And he looked after me, couldn't do enough for me at the end.
Yeah.
He gave me a map of where to go to. He goes, you got to go see this and you got to do that. And he drew things on a bit of paper and I thought, wow, okay, this is amazing. I go, this guy didn't even look like a Greek to me, in my opinion. Very dark skinned and had his gown on, but he was so connected to Greece. Yeah, so you can, you know, it's hard to explain. You can take, you know, through generations of people who weren't even born in Greece, got no connections with Greece, but were very Greek. The culture lived on.
Yeah.
Which makes you think, you know, 400 years, how the fuck did our culture survive, you know, and thrive in that time?
It's very interesting because I've seen videos recently, basically of thriving Greek communities, for example, in Egypt. I mean, it's nowhere near as big as what it used to be, but there is a Greek presence in Egypt. There's a Greek presence in, I think it was Colombia I saw as well, somewhere in South America.
Yeah,
you know, they've got a gyrathiko open in South America somewhere. You know, people eating gyro, you know, as their hangover food over there. But the key thing is wherever Greeks have gone, you know, whether it's to Australia or to the US or to Egypt or to South America, they've planted roots. They've assimilated to some degree, but they've held onto this culture and the traditions. And it's great for you and me when we go over there because of what you've just explained.
Yeah, no, I hear you, mate. And I remember that backpacking trip as well. I was with Angelo, my other mate. And we were... actually, it was really funny how we met because, again, we're talking about 95, so there's no internet back then. So I went backpacking first and he was going to be there at around the same time. So before we left Sydney, I said, where are we going to meet? And he goes, okay, let's look at a map. I found a map. So look, there's a McDonald's in, I think it was Omonia, quote me. In Athens. I said, okay, let's meet at that McDonald's at 12 o'clock on whatever the date was.
Yep. You know,
5th of June, for example. So 12 o'clock, 5th of June, we're going to meet there. Okay, and that's it. If you're not there between 12 and 1, come back the next day between 12 and 1. Okay, you might get held up. Something might happen. I said, that's how we
The Uzo's coming back up, eh?
What's that?
The Uzo's coming back
up. You heard it come up. Yeah. Hey, Tom, I had my second jab yesterday, so...
You're doing well. I'm going to get into this octopus.
Yeah, get into it. I've heard all the stories, you know, your second jab's worse than the first. Mm. So, good old Pfizer. I think I'm going all right for my second jab. Yeah, so good old Angelo. I said, we'll meet there at between 12 and 1, Omonia, Macca's, and that was it. Yeah, so we got there. I got there about 12 o'clock. I thought, fuck, what if he's going to turn up? Yeah, I spoke to him like 3-4 months ago. What's the chance of him turning up? And then, lo and behold, the door slides open. This fucking Angelo, hey, how are you? We hugged it out, and that was it. Then we went on, partied on all through Eos, Santorini, Mykonos. Amazing stories.
Mm. Well, mate, I'm sure we're going to go through a lot more of these stories as this podcast goes on. I mean, we've touched on a lot of things there. That sort of gives you a flavor of where we're going with this. As we said earlier, we're going to try and bring as many people in as possible for interviews. Again, Greeks within our community, Greeks who have a particular skill. So we hope people will enjoy it. I think we should take a look at the news now, Nick. So this is the part of the show where we'll take a look at some of the stories that have been coming out of Greece. So the first one, first cab off the rank, and this has been a big one over the last month or so, UNESCO's involvement in the attempt to get the Parthenon marbles back to Athens. Mm-hmm. So obviously UNESCO, which is the UN's cultural arm, recently called for the return of the looted Parthenon sculptures to Greece. That was around end of September. That's actually a huge move because that's never been done before. Nobody other than the Greek government has really come out before in an official capacity, certainly not from the, from a UN level, to ask for those marbles to be returned. The British Museum, as expected, rejected the notion, saying in a statement, "The museum is a unique resource for the world. The breadth and depth of its collection allows a global public to examine cultural identities and explore the complex network of interconnected human cultures. The trustees lend extensively all over the world, and over 3.5 million objects from the collection are available to study online. The Parthenon sculptures are a vital element in this interconnected world collection. They're a part of the world's shared heritage and transcend political boundaries." Now, the British Museum recently admitted that the Divine Gallery, where the marbles are housed, had suffered some water damage that's damaged their own claim when it comes to the safety of the marbles, which is one of the reasons they've used in the past to say Greeks can't take care of them. And look, the Acropolis Museum is in much better nick than the British Museum is. It's brand new. It's a world-class institution, purpose-built for the marbles. Nick, I mean, I don't know if you've been to the British Museum or the Acropolis Museum. What are your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, look, fiery opinions about this. But look, long story short, look, they've got to go back. I think there's no question. Yeah, look, Greeks were occupied at the time. You know, they shouldn't have been taken in the first place. And what? Look, I'm sure most Greeks understand it. Lord Elgin, they came in and they actually cut them off the Parthenon. These things were wrapped around the Parthenon, which is, you know, they've been there for, 3,000 years or something like that?
Yeah, it would have been, just on, around 2,000 years at that point.
2,000 years, they're wrapped around the Parthenon. This bloke comes in, had some sort of a deal with the Ottomans. Hey, we want to cut these things off. They literally sliced them off the Parthenon. They sliced them, they took them, even though they've been there for thousands of years and your ancestors have been there for thousands of years. They've come into your home. They've sliced these marbles up, which were, you know, pristine. They're classical, and they've shipped them back, and they're displaying them in another foreign country. You know, they shouldn't have taken them in the first place. It's just ludicrous to think that that they can sit there and sit back and say, they're out. We own them. When you took them, and you shouldn't have taken them in the first place. Yeah. You should have left them there. The Ottomans didn't want them. They didn't care. They ruled Greece for, 400 years or something? Occupied Greece, I should say. They occupied Greece for 400 years. They shouldn't have taken them. You know? They left them there. And it was it 1812? Don't quote me on the year, but it was just before the Greek independence kicked in. Greece was under occupation. They may have bribed or paid. I don't know. Look, for me,
there's a lot of ambiguity around the document that was signed in order to allow for the work to happen. And in any case, the only document that's actually been produced was actually not one to be able to remove the sculptures, but more to create casts of the to create copies of the sculptures. Mm. So. To Stephen Fry's point that he actually engaged in a debate some years ago, I think it was around 2011 or 2012 about this. Greece was under occupation, and to your point as well, if your neighbor has a fire or something along those lines, and you go in to take a painting, and put them in your garage to save them.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. And then your neighbor comes back a few years later and says, can I have my paintings back? And you say, oh, no, they'd be burnt if I didn't look after them.
Mm.
It's not very friendly at the very least. We've got good mates over in the UK, obviously, who come down on both sides of this argument.
True. But the Turks never really destroyed them, did they?
There's evidence to suggest they were using them for target practice.
Yeah. So now, the Parthenon was intact, wasn't it? And they had ammunition in there, and I think it might have been...
I think the Venetians did more damage to it than the Turks did at some point, because they were shooting at them.
Is that accidental?
Well, I think the story is, and correct us if we're wrong out there, but I think the story is that the Ottomans were actually keeping gunpowder on the site.
Correct. Had ammunition in there, and the Venetians had a a stray bomb that went off and it exploded. And
well, they were shooting at it. I don't think that they were, you know, that they were discriminating in any way. They yeah. just shot at it to some degree. At the end of the day, it's a 2,500-year-old structure that, by and large, is still standing. It's unbelievable in itself that it's still like that.
It's phenomenal.
To think that had Greece or Athens not gone through that occupation, to think that it may have been in a slightly better condition than what it is right now is unbelievable. I mean, look, at the end of the day, Greece did a fair bit of damage to it as well. In terms of, you know, it was converted to a church. It was, you know, so obviously it underwent a lot of changes through the Christian era. It was then converted into a mosque. You know, this is a building that is cross-section of its history. I mean, it is the same building that was obviously built, you know, 2,500 years ago by, you know, by those Athenians that voted to build it. Part of its story is that it's gone through all of this as well. The poor part about it is, you know, is this particular episode, which is basically Elgin coming in under dubious circumstances and dissecting and, you know, basically giving this building a lobotomy and taking it back to the UK. And again, I mentioned Stephen Fry. You know, his alternative to this, you know, the British Museum has a great way to get out of this in the sense that they can create molds of these sculptures and display those, but also curate videos and other mediums that they can show off in the Devine Gallery, where they're currently being housed, of them making those molds, doing the research around it, packaging them up and sending them over to the Acropolis Museum, where they, well, I mean, they wouldn't be united in the same building or, you know, atop the same mountain, but they would be within a few hundred meters of where they were originally displayed, and, you know, not that far away from where the marble itself was quarried. I mean, I don't know. Have you been to the Acropolis Museum since
I have. I have.
It's a fantastic museum.
It's state of the art. I actually found it better than the British Museum. Absolutely. I'm not being biased. They use the latest technology. There's no expense spared on this museum. Even the way the windows are positioned, you actually see the Acropolis in the background as you're looking at these amazing monuments. But look, it is very controversial. Lord Elgin did say he had a firman, which is a documentation to say that he had approval to go in and claim these marbles. The Ottomans at the time, they were very astute with their documentation. And a lot of their documentation at this time, again, I was having a read of this as well, and I said that they've got a lot of their documentation intact and it's still there. They could not find evidence of this. But if you go to the British Museum, they've got a document to say that they did ask for them and they had approval from them. But there's been a lot of people, I should say, I forget their names, but there's been a lot of people that say that these documents have been forged.
It's an Italian translation of the original document.
How does that work? So, look, it's a very interesting topic. The only right thing to do is you just got to hand them back. They're not yours. They're never yours. It's quite obvious they're stolen. Yeah, you took advantage of a country that was, you know, at the moment they were occupied. Now they're not occupied. You've got to hand them to the rightful owners. That was my opinion. Look, what's your views on this, Tom?
Yeah, look, they should obviously be returned. You know, Greece has the capability to look after them in what I would argue is an even better way than what the British Museum has. And look, I flatly disagree with the British Museum's opinion on it. Basically, looking at these objects through the prism of this is just one of many cultures. Whilst I understand that approach, the idea of having that particular piece of art or history sitting in that museum so far away from the city that it's all about makes absolutely no sense to me. The friezes and the metopes are all about that, the Battle of Marathon. It's all about the freedom of Athens. It's all about what we now know as, you know, classical Greece. It makes absolutely no sense to be putting that stuff in the British Museum putting it alongside other artifacts that, you know, that are obviously very important to other countries in, you know, in the world. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for us, it's very important. And, you know, the UK government and the British Museum has argued in the past that this is only a relatively new thing from the Greeks, you know, to long for these marbles in such a way. Mm. I disagree with that. They should just be handed back.
Yeah.
You know, do the right thing.
Oh, look, and with an apology as well. You know, they shouldn't have taken them in the first place.
I'll settle. I don't even need the apology. Just send them back.
They were wrapped around the Parthenon. They were in perfect condition. They've sliced them.
Yep.
You know, it was like a one sort of piece wrapped around them. It was an amazing feature, but they've sliced them now, put them in cargo containers and sent them off to London. So they've destroyed them, essentially.
Yeah, there was definitely damage done. And they actually did damage them once they were put in the museum to begin with, because they actually scrubbed them with something. So there was a fair bit of damage done there. Mm. And I think part of that was because they were under the impression that a lot of this artwork had actually been white to begin with. The Acropolis, you know, by all accounts, was actually a very colorful building, and they've actually found, you know, evidence of a number of different pigments on a lot of these statues. And, you know, we're quite used to thinking about Greek history as though, certainly the classical period, as being, you know, white marble and all that sort of thing. It was a very colourful period in the period in Greece's history. Well, it's ongoing, so we'll see what happens. I'm not sure that we'll see it in our lifetime. Hopefully we do, but let's just see what happens. Let's keep barracking for those marbles to be sent back. Well, let's move on to the next story. We're not really big on politics, but look, this next story has obviously been a big...
Too much we drink, Tom.
Yeah, true. This is obviously a big story, and, you know, it kind of, you know, Australia gets kind of thrown into this one a little bit to some degree. So Greece recently ratified the defence pact, a defence pact with France. Basically what it means is the Greek and French Strategic Defence Collaboration Agreement was voted on in Greek Parliament, and 191 votes in favour and 109 against the new pact. The main opposition party, Syriza, Kappa Epsilon, which is the Communist Party, and Meta 25.
Is that the user talking?
I think so.
Sorry, mate.
I know, right? I know. So Meta 25 all voted against the agreement. Mm-hmm. So the deal signed in Paris on September 28th states that Greece will buy 3 advanced frigates with an option for a 4th and a delivery date of between 2025 and 2026. The frigates will also be compatible with the jets Greece is also purchasing from France. It's already ordered some 24. I think they're called Rafales. I'm not sure how you pronounce it.
Rafael, yeah.
Something along those lines. Most importantly, though, the agreement also includes a clause for mutual assistance in case of armed attack against the territory of one of the two. So no prizes for guessing who they're worried about when it comes to Greece.
That's right.
So Prime Minister Mitsotakis told the parliament, you know, for the first time, it's clearly stipulated that there be military assistance in the event of a third party attacking one of the two states. And we all know who is threatening whom with a casus belli in the Mediterranean. So that's a clear reference to Turkey. Obviously, it's the tense situation. It's been a tense situation in the Mediterranean and on the Greek-Turkish border for a number of years now. What's so sad about this is that, you know, especially living in a country like, you know, like this, you know, we've got Turkish mates. We all get on.
Exactly, we get on.
You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense to us. So, I mean, what do you think of this one?
Look, it's very political. Look. Like I said, we've got friends here in Sydney. They're Turks. They're good blokes. We're friendly. We get on. I think the French getting involved, I guess it brings a bit of stability in the area as well. At the moment, I guess, again, it's only my opinion, Erdogan, it's very political. He wants, he's very nationalistic. He wants to, I guess that's his view of getting power, being very nationalistic.
I mean, okay, look, we talk about nationalism. Over the last few years, we've seen things like Turkish aircraft on a daily basis, you know, sort of flying into Greek airspace, military aircraft. Mm-hmm. And
so that's all deliberate. It's all very political, I think. I don't think the Turks really care.
Look, so that's my question. How much of that do you think is done purely for an internal audience in Turkey?
I'd say a big chunk of it, 90%. Look, I don't think Turks really care. Turks and Greeks sort of get on as a people. It's just very political.
Well, I've been to Turkey, and we couldn't have felt more welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
It was unbelievable.
Yeah, I've been there as well. Yeah, look, it's an amazing place. You know, I've been to Gallipoli and Cappadocia, and yeah, it's an amazing place. But look, it's very political. It's borderlining a dictatorship, I guess. But the good thing is, with Greece having France on board now, there's going to be, my gut feel is, there's going to be a bit of stability in the Greece is only a small country. We've got 10 million people versus, is it, what, 50, 60 million Turks?
I think it's even more than that.
Yeah, we're outnumbered, what, 6, 7, 8 to 1, whatever it is. So the good thing is, I think Mitsotakis deserves a bit of a praise here. Again, from Australia, we don't live in Greece. So we don't know what it's like domestically. Yep. But from an international front, I think he's doing a good job. Yeah, Greece, a small country, 10 million people. Mate, he's standing up to them. You know, we've got a country on the other side sending their jets over the border, sort of antagonising our fishermen, antagonising our islands. He's actually stood up to them. So from a diplomacy perspective, I think he's done a really good job for the Greeks in Greece, from an international perspective. Again, domestically, we don't live there. It's hard to comment.
Yeah, it is.
We hear different versions. You know, he's doing great, he's not doing great. But the deal we've got with France now, yes, definitely. We're someone to be reckoned with now. We've made some deals with United Arab Emirates and the Israelis as well. Unfortunately, what it is, it's all the natural gas and oil under the Aegean.
Yeah.
And it's all trying to, how do we carve that up? Mm-hmm. You know, that's what it is. So, look, I think he's done a tremendous job. You know, he's very well educated, very well respected amongst the international community from what we can see here in Australia. Again, we're a long way from all this. Getting embedded with France is a good thing. So how it pans out, I don't know.
Yeah.
It looks like Erdogan has possibly taken a back step now for this. You know, you're not just messing with Greece now, you're messing with Greece and one of the superpowers of Europe as well, or France. You know, we're going to have the frigates.
It's just interesting as well, because these are all NATO allies.
Correct.
As well.
That's the issue.
Yeah.
We're meant to be united, NATO. And this is the first agreement we've ever had with another NATO ally to challenge or to...
Another NATO ally.
Yeah, to shirt front another NATO ally, as you said. Yeah. Yeah, look, it's interesting times ahead, but from a Greece perspective, it's a good thing. Let's see how it pans out. Hopefully, Erdogan can back down. I think Mitsotakis is saying, let's work together.
Yeah.
You know, let's be friendly neighbours and move forward and progress the region, as opposed to trying to occupy our islands and so take our natural resources.
Yeah. Recently, we saw... Nikos Dendias go over to Turkey and actually meet with his counterpart. He told him point blank and in front of the cameras that they say one thing behind closed doors and a completely different thing to the public. And it was the most awkward. It was the most awkward press conference I think I've ever seen.
Really? Yeah, brief me. Yeah. I must have missed it.
Yeah, I can't remember exactly the full the full details of it. And the Uzoi is now really starting to hear this.
Thank you, Plumati.
Absolutely.
You legend.
Yeah, so no, it was. If you can find it online, it is fair dinkum one of the most one of the most uncomfortable press conferences ever. And Dendias actually finished the press conference by saying, I hope you won't hold this against me, because we have a dinner booked for straight after this press conference. He goes, and I'm starving.
Classic. Yeah. Look, they're not in a good place, the Turks, from a diplomatic perspective.
Yeah.
They purchased Russian anti-aircraft missiles as well.
Yeah.
And the Americans aren't happy, unfortunately. So they're saying, well, they had some sort of deal to purchase American aircraft.
The F-35, which is the newest military aircraft. And basically what they came out and said was that this is not compatible. You know, if you've got them working in the same thing, you know, it's figuring out basically all of its weaknesses.
Exactly. So you got the Russian anti-aircraft with the American fighter jet. It's a conflict of interest for the Americans.
Absolutely.
That's why they've pulled out on the deal.
Absolutely.
I read recently they want the F-16 aircraft now, which is a lesser model. But
and how old is the F-16 now?
It's pretty old. It's a good fighter jet. The Australians actually bought the F-35s, didn't they? We've got a shitload of them, haven't we?
I think so. Well, and now that you mention Australia, we recently saw that, you know, Australia isn't buying French equipment, the French submarines, in fact, and the French were pretty pissed off, to say the least, when Scott Morrison reneged on that deal. Greece, however, is getting into bed with France. Do you think that Australia's stance on reneging on the submarines has anything to do with France getting into bed with Greece, is what I'm saying? Because they lost a hell of a lot of money out of that deal.
Yeah, they did. Look, they're going to get compensated, but they would have made, you know, billions and billions of dollars, but they're going to get, what, $1 or $2 billion out of it, because we're reneging, the Australians, I should say, from this deal. But look, Australia had to get in bed with, again, superpower, exactly what Greece is doing. So we're in bed with, you know, the Brits, the Americans. You know, we've got a powerhouse like China on our doorstep. And Greece is doing the same thing. They've got Turkey on their doorstep. We're getting in bed with France. France, I guess, for the economy, I guess, it's all about economy. Military, purchasing all this hardware, it keeps economies up, keeps them floating. So France now citing doing everything to keep that Greek deal happening is a good thing for Greece, I guess. Mm. Yeah, they would have been pissed off. And the Governor General, their Foreign Minister they had here in Australia,
they called them
left.
Back. They called them back.
Yeah, but he left. They were pissed off. The French were really, really pissed off. Yep. They left. And now he's coming back, which is good. They're not happy with the Americans. But I guess the good thing for the Greece on an international level, that Biden is definitely supporting Greece on this front.
Yeah.
I read another article that the Emir Islands as well. He's basically said they're Greek.
I read that actually. Yeah, so the Library of Congress in the US, in all of their books, in all of their literature, basically the islets, you know, I think the Turks call them Kardak or something along those lines. Yeah, in all of the books, basically they're down as being Greek.
Mm.
So from a quality perspective as well, though, you know, you and I have both worked in aviation. You know, you think Airbus, you know, obviously comes from, you know, France and the EU in general. The US has Boeing and, you know, everyone else. Which one are you going to now, realistically, for your equipment? Whether it's military or otherwise, because Boeing's had a great deal of issues over the last few years, obviously with the 737 MAX. Airbus has picked up a little bit of the slack over the last few years, but you know the A380 has obviously been discontinued now as well. Both of those companies have bet on the wrong horse, you know, and both are involved in major military contracts now. Which one are you picking if you're the Prime Minister of a country?
Tough call. Look, if I'm a Mitsotakis, you'd have to stick with Airbus.
Mm.
You know, if you're Scott Morrison, you'd have to stick with Boeing. Mm. So Boeing, look, they've learned their lesson, the 737 MAX. I believe Qantas is looking at buying some of their aircraft. Mm.
I think it was primarily something to do with the software that was the issue.
Well, they did a shortcut from what I understand. They use the same software, same model as the 737-800, and they touched it up to be a more efficient aircraft.
Right.
Yeah, something along those lines, but they definitely paid the price for that. So they definitely brought them down a couple of pegs compared to Airbus. Airbus A380s, I guess that was the strategy they had. I think that you know, we're going to need to move more people more often. Therefore, Emirates went
hub to hub as opposed to point to point.
Correct. Yeah, they went berserk and they had Airbuses flying everywhere. But look, it might come back. It's hard. It's really predictable. That's why, you know, strategy is a huge, important piece in any institution.
Yeah.
We've got all these Airbuses. Apparently, Emirates have been parking their Airbuses strategically around the world, not to have these planes sitting around. But look, in my gut feel, I think everyone's going to start traveling again. The world's just going to take off. Yeah, there'll be an influx of people traveling again. I know in Australia where everyone's dying to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, trying to get to Bali, to Europe, to...
Well, as we're speaking, the Australian government has basically flagged the idea that international travel will resume towards the back end of November. And that's... I mean, that'll be primarily from New South Wales, which is... for those who are not Australian, where Sydney is, the state where Sydney is.
Yeah, exactly. We'll be able to get to London before we get to Queensland.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you know, we talk about flying 2 hours to Queensland, you know, just to get away, and yeah, to think that it's more likely that we'll be able to fly to London in the next month than to Brisbane is absolute nonsense.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It is.
But look, we've gone on a bit of a tangent, but Nick, I think that sort of rounds out our first episode. Look, what do you reckon?
I think so, Tom. We're getting the bottom, bloody. So I think that should wrap it up, I think.
Because
we're just going to start gibbering, and I don't know what we're going to. We'll be regretting if we hear back and what we're saying. So I think it's time to wrap it up.
I think so.
The octopus is gone.
The octopus is all gone. The olives are nearly gone. The plomari is definitely nearly gone. Okay. Well, look. Thanks everyone for joining us. You know, obviously we're still in our initial stages of getting this podcast together. If you want to get in touch with us, uzotalk@outlook.com. Send us an email. We'll be sharing our social media platforms really soon. Thank you to all of our sponsors. Thank you to everyone who's been a part of getting us to here. Nick, thank you very much for being part of this episode and for helping us get started.
Likewise, Tom. I think it's all you're doing. You're underestimating yourself. It's all you. I'm just tagging along with you and talking what we normally talk about.
This is the Uzo talking.
It is. It is. it's fantastic. Yeah. Look, it's been great. Look, if anyone disagree or agree with what we're saying, please comment. We'll probably mention it in our next podcast.
We'll have a mailbag of some description. We'll create these things as we go along. Stay tuned. We'll hopefully be having some really interesting interviews coming up and some really interesting discussions coming up as well. And we hope to speak to you really soon.
Ακολουθήστε μας στο Soundees, στο Spotify, στο Apple Podcasts και στο Google Podcasts.